Good morning, everyone. My name is Chandra Char. The title of my presentation is called Learning to Listen, Understanding the Healthcare Needs of the Deaf Community Through Medical Interpreters. I have no relationships to disclose. Currently, there are over 500,000 individuals in the U.S. that are deaf, and this number is growing due to the aging baby boomer population. Deaf individuals experience worse health outcomes, and this is due to poor access to healthcare, stigma, and lack of health education that's geared towards the deaf and hard of hearing community. And this all leads to high rates of cardiovascular disease, obesity, and many other life-threatening diseases. So the focus of my study are interpreters, and deaf patients communicate best with their healthcare providers when offered a qualified medical interpreter. Without interpreters, the chances of medical errors increase. And the current challenge is that there is no specific certification for medical interpretation in American Sign Language, and there is a shortage of qualified interpreters. So ASL interpreters provide a unique perspective. Few studies in the past have examined the role of that medical interpreters play in the delivery of healthcare for the deaf community, and the way in which they bridge the gap in communication. In addition, all the ASL interpreters that I used in my presentation and my project all were hearing, and they're very involved in the deaf community, so they have an understanding of deaf culture as well as how communication should flow appropriately with patients. So this is what I call the triangle of communication. So there's direct communication back and forth between the doctor and the interpreter, and back and forth between the interpreter and the patient. But as you can see, there's virtually no direct communication between doctors and patients. And that's something that I was interested in investigating, and that's something that I'll be talking about later. All right, so my research question is, what are the experiences of ASL medical interpreters who interpret between deaf patients and hearing healthcare providers? Well, thank you for asking. So I used purposive saturation and referral sampling. So I emailed local interpreters through the RID, or the Registry of Interpreters for the Deaf. I emailed 30 interpreting agencies all throughout California and Nevada. I posted recruitment flyers on websites in which I knew members, ASL interpreters, would be members of. I got referrals from participants and referrals from individuals in the deaf community. So I had two main criteria for participation in this study. One is that they must be a certified ASL interpreter. And the second is that they have a minimum of 10 clinical interpreting experiences since their RID certification. And RID is the Registry of Interpreters for the Deaf. So I did 10 ASL interviews in a rather mixed method of one Skype, one FaceTime, and 8 in-person interviews. And I know this is a rather non-traditional way of interviewing, but I did it this way because ASL interpreters were on call and they wanted to participate but weren't sure if they were able to meet in person. In addition, that they had experience doing video relay interpreting, so communicating this way was very simple for them and they were very comfortable with this. So, ethical considerations. I received an IRB exemption from my university's public health program. I obtained informed consent prior to the beginning of the interview, and I allowed participants to ask any questions prior to the beginning of the interview. And this was true for both virtual and in-person interviews. And I kept all the transcripts safe in a location where only I could access them. So, data collection. I did open-ended interviews using a guide, and I recorded all of the interviews and took notes during the interviews as well. I gave each participant a brief demographic survey for me to learn a little bit more about their connection with the deaf community and how they became an ASL interpreter. For my analysis, I hand transcribed all of my audio recordings and made transcripts. These transcripts were later analyzed using themes, patterns, and codes that were outlined in an Excel sheet. I used what's called grounded theory, which is a general methodology for developing theory that is grounded in data systematically gathered and analyzed, which means I did not create a hypothesis in the beginning, but I let the data evolve and create its own conclusions in the end using themes and common things that were said throughout all the interviews. So these are two questions that I asked in my demographic survey. I asked them when and how did they become an ASL interpreter? And 30% of them said that they were native users, which means they grew up using ASL. 60% of them said they took a formal class either through college or through an interpreting program. And 10% of them said that they learned ASL in a mixture of different ways. Their connections with the deaf community, we had 30% of them that were coded as a child of a deaf adult, which means one or more of their parents are deaf. And ASL was their primary language at home. And 70% of them said something, their connection with the deaf community was something other. So meaning a friend or a roommate is deaf and introduce them into deaf culture, or they are an ASL interpreter and are very involved in deaf culture themselves. So this is my framework that I use to analyze all the transcripts. Now the boxes that are in white evolved from the questions that I asked in my interviews, and the part in the orange box is what evolved from the interviews themselves. So these are things that were common throughout the interviews that interpreters brought up themselves during conversation. So I'm going to go ahead and go through this individually. So pathway to becoming an ASL medical interpreter. So there's currently no medical certification for ASL, and that's what this participant number 6 is saying, is that it's not out there yet. There's currently a certification for education and one for law, but not for medicine. So the role of the interpreter is converting source language into target language, but they also act as a liaison. And as participant number 3 is saying, is that many healthcare providers don't really understand how to communicate with deaf patients. And so they do bridge that gap of communication, but they also do cultural liaison work as well. So there's this code of conduct that is set by the RID that sets a standard of professionalism throughout all ASL interpreters. But even though there is this professional standard that they hold, they still develop rapport with patients because they often interpret for these same patients throughout their entire diagnosis. But it is important for them to, no matter what the relationship is with their patient, to maintain professional boundaries, because it is often easy for them to feel more like a family member than an interpreter. One of the main parts of the professional code of conduct set by the RID is that, like participant number 1 says, you cannot add, you cannot subtract, and you cannot counsel. Emotional involvement. So ASL interpreters enjoy being part of the deaf patient's process, and they enjoy being there for deaf patients. But it is often difficult for them to deliver bad news. They have to take these same words that the doctor says and bring this information to the deaf patient using the same level of emotion. And often that's really hard when you have to deliver bad news. And this is an example that participant number 5 is saying, is just having to deliver a bad news and a sad diagnosis to a patient is often really hard for some interpreters. Being an advocate and educator, it's a huge part of being an ASL interpreter, because they're not just there to take words and spoken English and convert it to ASL and the other way around. They're there also to advocate and educate, both on the side of patients and on the side of healthcare providers. And they feel passionate about aiding and supporting the deaf community. And like participant number 6 is saying, is that they really do have this power to advocate and to empower deaf patients to ask questions, be part of their healthcare, ask questions and be more involved. And this way they can feel like they're more of a participant. Positive experiences. The bottom line is that ASL interpreters really enjoy making a difference in someone's life. They often feel like if they weren't present in that situation, that a deaf patient would not have the information that they're given, that there may be issues in communication, and so they really enjoyed it. And overall, most of the participants had more positive than negative experiences as an interpreter. And this is just an example. Participant number 2 is giving an example of just a really positive experience that they had while interpreting. So some negative experiences. There's time constraints. on the side of healthcare providers. And this comes from each doctor is only given a certain amount of time with a patient. And often when an ASL interpreter is involved, this doubles the amount of time of communication. And like participant number four says, this is just the frustration that healthcare providers have when using an ASL interpreter, and it's really sad to see this. In addition, there's a misunderstanding of the interpreter's role. They're not a family member, and they're not there to make observations about a patient's health. They're there to facilitate communication and be a liaison for this patient. And interpreting medical jargon, often it's very challenging for ASL interpreters to interpret medical jargon. It's not their job to clarify or explain, and oftentimes they find themselves having to do that because healthcare providers and doctors, they tend to just throw out this information and throw out these words that are not clarified, and so the interpreter has to do that, but it's not really their job. So all of this leads to ideas for improvement. So really we need to have more interpreters, and because there are more jobs than there are interpreters. And training for healthcare providers in cultural competency and how to communicate with deaf patients. And on-staff ASL interpreters in hospitals that are there 24 hours and can act as a liaison and as an interpreter. So instead of a hospital calling an agency who then calls an interpreter, and that could take up to 6 to 8 hours, leaving a patient waiting and scared and confused. And medical certification for ASL interpreters. And this is kind of an interesting quote. It's kind of funny, please pardon the foul language in the text, but this participant is just talking about how the frustration from patients about how challenging it is often for them to communicate in certain situations. So there are limitations to my study. Sampling bias of participants in the study may have been more inclined to participate because they're passionate about the subject. I have my own connection with the deaf community and I'm proficient in ASL. The interviews varied in location and mode, and it's important to remember that this is non-generalizable. The results are in this study may or may not represent the entire population of ASL interpreters in the nation or the world. So my conclusions are that ASL interpreters play a crucial and very important role in educating and advocating both on the side of healthcare providers and on the side of patients, in addition to bridging this communication gap. And also highlights the need for medical certification. And this will just set a standard for medical interpreting in ASL all throughout the nation to ensure that all patients are given the same information and accurate information and interpretation. There's also an opportunity here to educate healthcare providers on cultural competency and how to communicate with deaf patients. And once again, we have this triangle of communication, but this time we have a red dotted line because we understand a little bit more about how doctors and patients can communicate directly with one another, but there still needs to be more work done. These are my references. And I'd like to thank many people who have helped me make this project possible. The deaf community who have been incredibly supportive, and my participants who this would have not been happening if they weren't involved. Dr. Brody, who is my advisor, and Dr. Georgia Sadler, Dr. McKee, and Dr. Engelman for their continual support and for helping me make this a culturally competent study and for always supporting this project. And that's all. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed all four presentations. I'm going to have Monica going to be bringing around the microphone for any specific questions. So if you could just raise your hand, and then we'll bring the microphone. Okay, that one there.
The study, I don't have my program on me, so I'm not sure who's who. Yes, I'm Barbara Cornwell. I'm on the section, I'm the policy chair for the section. And the gentleman all the way to the right. I'm wondering if you'd be willing to share your data, because we're always looking for data that relates to things that we can use to support policy.
Sure. Yeah, define what you mean by shared data.
Right now we're very interested in, there's some issues with how the compounding factor of race on top of disability, so some of that data is the result. results. Okay. A little more specific results.
Yes, so basically this study, we've written a manuscript on it and it's under review right now. So as soon as that comes out of embargo, it'll be really easy to send out. So if you want to give me your contact info later, I'll be sure to send that to you.
I will. Thank you. And I also wanted to bring up that keep watching your emails, because the NHITS is in revision and they're talking about getting rid of some of the disability questions. And when you mentioned how difficult it was to get the data, imagine how much more difficult it will be if they make changes to the NHITS. So we may be calling on you as members of the section to sign-on letters and to yell and scream to keep that in place. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? We got three up. Okay.
I'm Susan Haberkamp at Ohio State University, and I had a question for several of the panelists and questions in the deaf community about any strategies that you found effective in recruiting participants for trying to offer health promotion curriculum in ASL and having a hard time getting people to sign on. It's a big time commitment, but we do have some compensation that we can offer, and I just wondered if anyone had tips.
I'll start with that. I like to think of myself as a recruitment queen. Getting people involved with studies, and I think Marjorie can attest to that. It's all about connection and relationship, as well as being aware of what's out there. There are some different listservs that can be used that go out, and you know, but there isn't one particular sort of answer to that question of how to do it. I know that people out in Rochester area who have similar struggles with, you know, getting people to be involved. But I think once you have a relationship, you know, I get pretty good responses. So knowing what's available in the communities, what are the larger areas where you have the different demographics, reaching out, again, it depends on what you mean by that. Do you want people who are connected with different kinds of services? Do you want people who are just sort of general deaf community members? Do you want professionals? Do you want educated, non-educated, working people, people on SSI? It kind of depends what you're looking for. So I have some cards here. I'd be more than happy if separately if you want to communicate with me. I can give you some ideas, but it really depends on who you're targeting. If it's just a deaf person in general, or something more specific. Usually, we're looking for something a little more specific. I hope that answered your question.
Hi. I would like to give a little response that, yes, well, one thing, it helps to know deaf Dustin, and she knows everybody everywhere.
I don't know.
It helps. It helped our project a lot. We are continuously looking for new sources to recruit different groups in the deaf community who we want to reach. And we are finding increasing luck with using the internet, assuming that we're on the sites of deaf people who are sort of, to some extent, very natural users of the internet. So we can get the right site. And I think it also helps to have the right endorsement. So that endorsement comes from inside the deaf community. So it helps you working with people as researchers or as partners who are inside. And they are your key doing that. I will be talking in another session later today. I just wanted to mention that has to do with instrument development, but also recruiting people from around the country. And that's at a mental health session. This is the mental health paper. It's at 4:30 and it's 4441. So that's another session where I'll be talking and includes the recruitment.
I'm going to chime in real quick. I think two things is persistence and having someone that's like a buy-in. So it's just keeping persistent and putting it out there, and then you'll catch the eye of someone who will be really just as passionate about it as you are, and then they'll be like your advocate, and they'll go and tell their friends and tell people, and they'll help recruit for you. And that's always the greatest thing, because coming from an outsider, they're kind of like questioning, like, what your intentions are, but if it comes from someone they know, they'll be more than likely to participate.
Thank you. There were a couple others.
Yes, I'm Lynn Longwheel from the University of Massachusetts Medical School, and I've been hearing from folks in our local deaf community that the use of video remote interpreters by hospitals is on the increase, and that a lot of deaf folks find this really problematic. The first person I was interested in having answer my question was Chandra Char, but anyone else on the panel who has any comments on that, I'd be very interested to hear what you have to say.
Well, thank you for your question. Yes, absolutely. That was actually one of the things that my participants were talking about, is that it's not making live interpreting obsolete, but it's definitely becoming a go-to for hospitals. And originally it was intended to be just for emergency situations, just to not leave the patient there waiting. But now it's become like a crutch that hospitals are using. And from what I've been told by my interpreters that I interviewed, is that deaf patients absolutely just hate it, because oftentimes it's placed in a very inconvenient place, especially they use it a lot during childbirth. And so it's hard for patients to see it, and oftentimes the Wi-Fi connection is poor, and then for the interpreter on the other end, there's a lot of conversations happening in the room at the same time, so they don't know what to interpret, so oftentimes they're interpreting things that aren't even part of the patient's conversation, so it gets really confusing. But I guess this is kind of a band-aid, like if an interpreter is not available, or in a rural area, or something like that, it could work, but yeah, it's not really the best situation.
As someone who can speak to it from both sides, because I am certified as a sign language interpreter and do some relay interpreting as well, but also it ties into a conversation we had in the last session. It should be really, the intent was for emergency situations, it was not for sort of routine situations. You have no control over the interpreter that's going to be on the screen, so the relationship is lost, and when there's reoccurring kinds of situations or something that's long-term, the interpreters switch. And the skill level, just because the person's certified doesn't mean, especially going back to sort of the specialized kinds of needs for different situations, doesn't mean they're the best qualified for that particular person. And video relay kinds of situations, a person can request a different interpreter, but if it's a very stressful situation, you know, that's putting a lot of burden onto someone that's already feeling pretty stressed and tense. And how many times are you going to switch until you get, you know, the right person that's a fit? Some hospitals I know have contracts with certain companies or certain individuals. And I know some deaf people who can, through some of those situations, but that's far and few between, have particular people they request and work with in remote situations. So if you're going to do that, you know, that would be the suggestion, if there's a way to do that. But with the larger companies, there isn't. So if you have a contract with a particular company that's providing the service, and they can guarantee you particular people, highly skilled, you know, that's one thing. But if you're using the ones that are out there most used, and there's what, 20, 30 different companies, they can't make any guarantee. You get whoever pops up on the screen at that moment. So it really isn't highly recommended for all those reasons and many, many more.
Excuse me, Suzanne Salter from Villanova University. I have a question related to you and the instruments that you were talking about. The one is the compression.
Yeah.
You indicated that once it was translated, it took something like 30 some minutes to complete. Am I correct?
The back compression has, how many of you are familiar with the back compression in turn and use it? So it's 21 questions, and each one has 4 responses. 2 of the questions then skip up to having, you know, more than 4 responses possible. So because of expansion that's needed for the concept, it's not just reading the, you know, I feel discouraged about my life. As I mentioned, the word discouraged doesn't have one particular sign. So you have to expand the concept to make sure conceptually it's being understood. So on average, it may take up to 30 or 40 minutes to really sit and watch, and that's just one time through with the expansion that's used for everything. Now, that's just on average. We're just starting with, you know, getting it out there for field testing, so we're still early in the research. We had 30 people do our back translation, and as I mentioned, we had to retake the majority of them two or three times. And then we are just doing the cognitive interviewing now, and then we'll be sending it out for field testing. That's the one I think the field is most excited about because it's used most prevalently. So hopefully that will scare people away from taking advantage of the fact that it'll be accessible to deaf people who are ASL users.
Well, the rest of my question is, you were talking, if I'm not mistaken, about administering several instruments, at least that's part of your plan. I mean, it sounds like the response, I mean, the burden in terms of the instruments is going to be huge, and so you need to select the instruments carefully so that you don't overburden people.
Well,
right?
Well, what we're trying to do is have a number of options available to people. It doesn't mean that you would necessarily, as you know, an evaluator, go through all these 8 instruments that are available to you. If you're a substance abuse assessor, maybe you would have interest in using the AUBIT or the DAST, or you would have interest in using SAS-ASL, which is based on the SASE, but we were able to get it down to 30 questions instead of 75, and still have pretty good validation. Or if you're a vocational rehab counselor, which they might use the ONET, and we're doing a 60-question interest inventory that goes with that, that has all these different resources online already through the Department of Labor. Or, for instance, in Kentucky, the GAME, which is a 23-question instrument that's based on substance abuse and behavioral, are now requiring that they do it with kids in high school. Now they're excited because that will be an option in American Sign Language instead of English. So it's really an online suite of assessments that there will be a private portal which will be developed that people will be able to pick from, not that you would use all of them. Is that answered?
The reason that I included a little bit about the VDI is because it's something to think about if you're modifying your own instrument. So the VDI, because there's a separate video for every single concept, it takes a lot longer than you think. With a survey where you have a Likert scale, for example, and the answers are the same, much faster. So the range for our different instruments that we're working with now and how long it takes to go through them, mm-hmm. some of them are less than 10 minutes. And some of them are much longer. So I bring it up only because it's something to think about when you're choosing to move over to doing those in American Sign Language. You've been doing them online and on film. It is something to think about. You would pick up that instrument the first time and think, oh, sure, we should use this. This is an easy one to do. Not always so easy. So
I wanted to comment that if people are willing to stay around and come to the session, and which I'm not listening to, I'm like an add-on later that 4441. I'll be talking about developing a new instrument in American Sign Language, for also for depression screening. That is one of many very common use and for reasons you'll find out we chose to do a new one that was tied to DSM criteria. But we specifically chose, standardized response categories for exactly this reason, that it would cut down on the time and number of clips. We could have gone either way, and we chose the format for that very reason. It is to take the burden off of people who are doing it in ASL.
I just want to add one other thing. For instance, the ONET. Are any of you familiar with the ONET career? You know, it's an excellent resource. We were going to develop our own to cover sort of the career area, and there was this wonderful resource where it'll even tie in based on your interest to jobs in your area, to where you can get trained for those jobs. I mean, it's really wonderful. And although it's 60 questions, which we hope, again, once we get it out there that we can reduce it down and select a good validity, because that's a lot, it's quicker to do than that VDI, which I'm still the most excited about, because I know many colleagues that use the VDI and feel good about it. But the BBI has been the most challenging of all of them because of all the linguistic nuances within it. So, you know, it's an interesting process. You know, if you're interested in validation and just all of it, it's fascinating, whether it's in spoken languages or in American Sign Language, but even more so in American Sign Language, just because of the way the language translates, and it's not going to work for everybody. Because just because you're deaf and fine, it doesn't mean that you use fine at the same level as someone else. So this would not necessarily work for people who are low functioning in terms of their language, with minimal language skills. You need to still probably have a professional with them, but it helps to have some consistency and validation related to recommendations of how to get some concepts across, so that the deaf person might choose the deaf professional, or the deaf fluent or hearing fluent signing professional might look at this and glean some ideas themselves of how to communicate those concepts when they're working one-on-one with the client. So there's a lot of good uses.
Hi, I'm Meg Tracy from the University of Montana Rural Institute for Inclusive Communities, and I just wanted to add one dimension of, you know, from independent living for those living in rural America, having options is great. And for an interpreter who is not part of a very tight rural community, or an individual to be able to have very confidential conversations with their healthcare provider, is a good option, I think, that we just need to be aware of, especially when we are talking about opportunities to report on abuse. The other thing I just wanted to ask Dr. Bennett, how you were able to stratify rural using the MEPS data and from that methodology.
Yeah, so the MEPS data, it's not a great rural variable. It's metropolitan statistical area versus not, because that's the public use data. As you probably know, there's many different definitions of rural, and we have to go through a large process to get any other one. So it's not perfect, but it gives you some idea.
Any other questions? All right. Want to give a round of applause?